big hello and welcome to Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick. If this is the first time you're tuning into this show, I can tell you that we are the only radio show in South Africa that offers an hour-long book show, jam-packed with reviews and author interviews. And today's show is absolutely no different. In fact, we have 5 reviews, a mix of fiction and non-fiction, and that'll be followed up with 3 author interviews. All 3 of these are with local authors. So we're very excited to host this show, which is sponsored by Exclusive Books. I'm going to jump straight in because we've got so much content in today's show. I've barely got a second to waste. We'll start the show with Vanessa Levenstein talking about One of the Good Guys by Ariminata Hall. I'm told that this book has lots of twists and turns, and you'll never see the surprise ending coming. No spoilers here, though. After that, for a change, we go to a slightly older book. This one's called The Eighth Life, and it's by Nino Haratshivli. This was on the Booker long list years ago, but I'm told it's still an incredible read. Then we'll be joined by Rachel van der Pfeffer, who's our YA reviewer, that means young adult, and she'll be chatting about a book called The Cartographers by Amy Zhang. Then we have our nature segment of the show. I told you, this show is jam-packed, and that's hosted by John Hanks, who will be chatting about a very interesting-sounding new tracker manual. And then to round off all our reviews, Twanji Kalula will be chatting about a book called Power and Faith by Poncho Pilani. Then we head into our interviews. Beryl Eichenberger is chatting to Fiona Snikers about her latest novel called The Hidden. This one, set in America, features a cult and an FBI agent. I enjoyed this one. The next interview is with Nancy Richards, who's chatting to Margie Orford about her new memoir, which is called Love and Fury. And finally, we'll round off the show with a little bit of bullshit. Philip Todras is chatting to Jonathan Anser about his latest book, which is coming out just in time for the elections, and that's called, as I said, Bullshit. And all these reviews will be bookended by some very fine music. So, welcome to the show. Let's get going. As I mentioned, first up is Vanessa Levenstein with a book bite of a book called One of the Good Guys by Ariminata Hall. Welcome to the show, Vanessa.
One of the Good Guys by Ariminata Hall is a chilling account of how gender-based violence is not only pervasive in our real world, but fueled and mirrored on social media. Sadly, but not surprisingly, as we all to a greater or lesser degree live in the place where our thumbs do the talking. In fact, this review started with a WhatsApp chat with editor Paige Nick, who was in Hong Kong at the time. Me. Finished the book. Nothing could have prepared me for the plot. Emoji. Paige, great. Will you review it? Me, no. Paige, why not? You said it was good. Me, I'm too scared I'll give away the plot, reveal spoilers, and get sent to book reviewers' detention. Paige, come on, just a book bite then. Another emoji. So here goes. For about 100 pages, I was irritated, thinking I knew exactly what was going to happen. It was all so obvious. Should I continue? Yes, no, yes. Thankfully, I did, just in time for the author to punch me in the solar plexus. The story is told by 3 narrators. A man named Cole, who is one of the good guys. His estranged wife, Mel, and a famous artist, Lenny. We also go online to Walk for Women and read about 2 young women who are walking to highlight gender-based violence. Cole has sought refuge from his crumbling marriage in a remote cottage on the edge of a nearby cliff. How dramatic is that? Here he meets Lenny, who's preparing for her new art show. They become friends. The 2 young women, walking to raise awareness, pitch their tents close by. And all is well until they vanish into thin air. Have they fallen off the cliff? Been abducted? The book examines what it takes for us, as society, to react to gender-based violence. How hard is it to be heard above what sadly has become just another Me Too story? Recent global events have tragically revealed how society's reaction to gender-based violence is reminiscent of George Orwell's Animal Farm. All victims are to be believed and supported, but some more than others. One of the Good Guys is chilling because the real and virtual world collide to... I'm going to delete the sentence and I'm stopping right here before I give the plot away.
Next up, Shirley Gula joins us. You know, we usually chat about brand new releases on this show. But all of us, well, I know I do, I have piles and piles of old books piled up in my home and sometimes in my car too. And I always plan on reading them and then something new and shiny comes in. But I got to say, when I do finally get to my backlist, as I like to think of it, of older books, I'm very rarely disappointed. I have one friend who won't allow herself to read any new books until she's at least hit out one of the books on her old book list. And I'm not quite as disciplined. I just kind of go for whatever hits me next. But Shirley Guler tells me that even though this was published some years ago and it was on the booker list some years ago, she says it's still incredible. So we thought we'd still like to share it with you. Hi, Shirley.
Since it's Booker Prize time once more, I was so happy to come across a previous longlister, The Eighth Life by Nino Haratishvili. Georgian by birth, she now lives and writes in Germany, and the German edition was read and raved about by someone in my household. So I ordered from Exclusive Books, who had to bring it in for me from overseas, all 934 pages in English, and I devoured it, every single word on every single page. It's a family saga, for want of a better description, but one in which each person has a story, one that captures the history of Georgia and the countries around her, in fact stretching up to England, from the October Revolution in 1917 in Moscow right up to 2007. While the story takes in the Hungarian Revolution, the Velvet Revolution, and the Prague Spring, it's not about revolutions, but about those who make them and those who break them, a deep backdrop to eight deep lives. The lives begin with Anastasia, whose childhood embraces hot chocolatier father and the accursed chocolate recipe, and ends with Brilka, the runaway child, mature beyond her years. Through the eyes of Stasia and those of her stunningly beautiful yet inherently doomed and tragic sister Christine, we learn about the revolutionaries, the white soldiers and the communists, the little big man who was Barrier, the rapes and the killings, the total disregard for life, and those the rapists begat. Through the eyes of Stasia's children, Kostya and Kitty, we learn about dedication and greed for money and power, as well as tragedy and survival. Through Kostya's almost totally estranged daughter, Elena, we learn how parents can fail at so much. Through the eyes of Elena's children, Daria and Nitsa, we learn how relationships falter, about the equal measure of love, hatred, and jealousy between sisters. Finally, through Daria's daughter, Brilka, we see the reason for everything, absolution and the chance of a good outcome. Of course, Brilka's story is yet to unfold, but the potential to follow in Kitty's footsteps is surely a story in the making. I hope so. But more than that, above the compelling horror of the times countered by the ability to soar, we can savor the most powerful and most beautiful prose in excellent translation. Envy for Haratishvili's ability underlies every word I've read here. And even though the pages in my paperback copy are beginning to fall out, I will read the book again and, if I have a chance, buy it in hardcover.
And now we're going to move straight on to our next review, which comes from Rachel van der Pfeiffer, who is our resident YA reviewer. That's young adult novels. Rachel reads quite widely. So if you have a young adult in your life, if you enjoy young adult fiction, this sounds like it's one to look out for. It's called The Cartographers. It's by Amy Zhang. And it's published by HarperCollins.
The Cartographers by Amy Zhang. 17-year-old Ocean Sun has just moved to New York. While her mother believes she's in college, in actuality, Ocean has secretly deferred her acceptance for a year and moved into a Brooklyn apartment with new roommates Tasha and Georgie. One night, alone in the subway during a citywide blackout, Ocean meets a mysterious stranger, Constantine Brave. From a personal perspective, as someone who's read a lot of dystopian and fantasy novels recently, this book made a really refreshing change. The book covers some darker themes, including mental health, and overall was quite a heavy read, but I really enjoyed it and I thought it was really well written. My only issue was that sometimes the conversations between characters dragged out a bit too long and were too unnecessarily philosophical. I should acknowledge that these philosophical discussions are more important aspects of the book, but at some points it just got a bit too much. The Cartographers is written by Amy Zhang and published by HarperCollins.
And now for something slightly different. We have John Hanks joining us in our Nature Book slot with news of a new tracker manual. Hi, John Hanks.
What a pleasure to review the fully revised and updated edition of Tracker Manual, a practical guide to animal tracking in Southern Africa, a book packed with not only the latest information on the art of tracking, but also with some 200 new photographs, new drawings of spoor, and with the inclusion of an additional 35 species. Featuring mainly large and small mammals, the guide also includes a selection of amphibians, reptiles, birds, and invertebrates. What makes this book so appealing to me is the 33-page introduction to tracking, including how to read tracks and signs, and how the appearance of a track impression is directly influenced by the structure and shape of the animal's foot, by the way it moves, and the substrate on which the track is produced. Traditional tracking skills evolved in Africa thousands of years ago, but with increasing urbanization, society no longer required the expertise of hunter-gatherers, and their skills disappeared at an alarming rate. Some exceptional, talented trackers still remain, including the authors of this guide, individuals who are constantly learning and honing their skills, paying close attention to each animal's behavior, social structure, habitat, and diet preferences. Seasonality should also be considered when following animal trails. For example, in the hot summer months, leopards spend more time in the top of trees and the top of termite mounds to take advantage of the breeze. Droppings or scats along the tracks can also help with identification, and with predators give information on their preferred prey species. The guide comes into a class of its own with a detailed description of each species, with excellent photographs of tracks accompanied by drawings of them with measurements, and a particularly helpful section at the end of each species account, entitled, and I quote, "can be confused with," then dot, dot, dot. And this part calls attention to details such as the shape and size of the toes and the nature of the claw mark, if present, to help with resolving confusion as to which species it is. The section on carnivorous mammals includes 14 species, with accounts of their habits, feeding and diet, droppings and behavior, and with what I regard as essential information on precautions to be taken when following some of these tracks on foot. For example, noting that lionesses with cubs and wounded lions are potentially very aggressive, the advice here is very clear. I quote, "If a lion charges, the golden rule is to stand still until it has stopped. Shouting or throwing something at it during a charge would unnerve an aggressive animal," end quote. Well, this, of course, is easier said than done. But as the authors emphasize elsewhere in the book, the animals being tracked are wild and their behavior is unpredictable. Tracker Manual has four very experienced authors: Alex van der Heerfer, Benias Mflongo, Paro Benardi, and Ian Thomas. And the first three are active members of the Tracker Academy, an NGO that teaches wildlife tracking in southern Africa. The dedication of this team is encapsulated on the front page, with a message that all the royalties from the sale go to the Tracker Academy. This is a superb production. I think it should be in the library and backpack too of all wildlife enthusiasts in southern Africa. The title again, Tracker Manual, Practical Guide to Animal Tracking in Southern Africa. It's just been published by Straight Nature, an imprint of Penguin Random House, and you can get a copy for 450 Rand.
And finally, to round up our review section of the show, Twanji Kalula joins us, and he's chatting about a new novel called Power and Faith by Poncho Pilani. Twanji and I discussed whether we should review this book on the show, whether we want to mix in a bit of religion, and we thought, why not? Because in this memoir and analysis, Poncho investigates the dangers of uninterrogated belief in Pentecostal churches and how these beliefs affect our everyday lives. We thought it might be interesting to open the conversation. Over to you, Twanji.
The commonly accepted wisdom is that it's never a good idea to talk about politics or religion in public. And given where we come from as a country and the upcoming elections, it's a given that politics will come up a lot. But religion is still one of those conversational topics that make many of us feel uncomfortable. In her book, Power and Faith, How Evangelical Churches Are Quietly Shaping Our Democracy, journalist Poncho Pilani tackles both subjects fearlessly from a place of deep personal experience. In recent decades, American-style evangelical megachurches have become increasingly popular in South Africa, providing a spiritual home for people from all walks of life. One of the areas where these churches have made huge inroads is on university campuses, where like-minded students are able to form student chapters that feed into these churches and foster new generations of members and leaders. This was Pilani's own entry point into a multiracial megachurch with a national footprint. Pilani entered the church as a student and quickly rose up its youth leadership ranks, taking on the responsibility of recruiting new members, running cell groups, and building the church's presence on campus. Over time, the church's financial, emotional, and time demands proved strenuous and competed with her studies, driving her to burnout and then disillusionment. After she finally left the church, she realized that her experience as a senior youth leader left her damaged. Her experience as part of the church proved life-changing and forced her to deeply explore her faith and the role that powerful churches play in shaping public policy and society in our democracy. Her experience as part of the church coincided with important moments like Fees Must Fall, when her personal politics and belief clashed with the church's message at the time. The book seamlessly moves between chapters that read like a memoir and chapters that are more academic and offer deep analysis of the role that powerful churches play in South Africa and the rest of the world. She explains how these churches played a role in the transition from apartheid and how their political influence still holds today. One of the things she does really well is that she lays out how aid funding from countries like the US is often accompanied with church-sanctioned restrictions that affect our views and access to important services like family planning and even abortion. I have no doubt that the book will have its fair share of detractors. That is to be expected. Pilani does explore the idea that these churches operate like multi-level marketing schemes and even cults, which is no doubt something that will upset their thousands of members. But most importantly, Pilani talks about the tension that will always exist between religion and a secular state, and casts a light on the role that faith plays as we move through 30 years of our democracy. Overall, I admired Pilani's bravery and the amount of work she put into stating her case. It was thought-provoking, which is what a good book should be, right? There were a few proofing errors which made parts of the book a little difficult to make sense of at times, but I have no doubt that the publishers will address these before the next reprint. Power and Faith by Ponso Pilani was published by Tafelberg and retails for 280 Rand.
Right, after that feast of fiction and non-fiction reviews, we're going to go in for a track and we'll come back and we'll have three wonderful author interviews to share with you. This track is Norwegian Wood by Tessa. Welcome back. You're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick. And our wonderful show is wonderfully sponsored by Exclusive Books. As I mentioned, we have three interviews today with three South African authors. I love promoting South African fiction and nonfiction on this show. We have an incredible range of talent, and they're up against quite tough odds, up against all the international books that come out and little shelf space and small budgets of publishers. So we like to give them as much airtime as we can. And the three we've selected for today are particularly good ones. They all come recommended. Beryl Eichenberger is chatting to the very accomplished author and podcaster, Fiona Snackers, about her latest novel, The Hidden. We have talked about this book on the show before. I've read it and enjoyed it, and one of the publishers mentioned it as well. So here it is again with the author's perspective on it. Welcome to the show, Beryl and Fiona. Thanks for joining us.
On a previous publisher's choice, much was said about Fiona Snickers' new book, The Hidden. So what better than to hear from the author herself? She spans many genres, which for me always makes the read engaging, because I'm not quite sure what to expect, and I've never been disappointed. From light reads like The Trinity Books, The School Gates, to Lacuna, a response to J.M. Coetzee's Disgrace and more, I am awed by the fact that she can switch so skillfully. The Hidden brings us into the realms of thriller, domestic noir, a survivalist group, a terror bombing, an FBI agent, and a family with secrets. A page-turner of note. But I think we should let Fiona tell us about this many-layered, gaspingly good new novel. Hi, Fiona, and a very warm welcome to Book Choice.
Hi, Beryl, and thank you for having me on.
Well, we're delighted, I must say. Fiona, how would you describe this book?
I think you captured it well. It's an FBI thriller crossed with domestic noir, but I would say it's mostly about one ordinary family and the lengths that they will go to protect the life that they've built and to keep the secrets of the past hidden.
Mm-hmm. I am very, very interested in where your ideas come from. I mean, this is completely different. It's set in the States, obviously, with the FBI, which is quite removed from where you normally write about South Africa. So tell us how this book started.
It came about during the Trump years and the COVID years, when the world felt very out of control to me. Mm-hmm. And as a form of personal therapy, I started writing this book because it was a world that I could control. I could decide what the priorities of the authorities were. And I could imagine a kind of post-Trump world, maybe a gentler kind of world, a world where a woman was president mm-hmm. of the USA. And it was just a way of getting me through those years. And because it was set in America, I wasn't at all sure that it was ever going to be published. So it just felt like a story between me and my laptop, which kind of freed me to tell the story that I had been wanting to tell for a while.
Well, I mean, I like the fact that at the beginning of the book, you put that this is post-Trump era with a woman president. But it's not actually gentler, is it? Because of this terrible terror attack. And then were you influenced by 9/11 when that became part of the novel?
To the extent that that was a terrorist attack that had happened in the past mm-hmm, on U.S. soil, and it created such a backlash, such an unfair backlash in the lives of ordinary Muslim people mm-hmm. who had absolutely nothing to do with the attack. And it seemed to me that America was ignoring the real threat, which to my mind is the threat of the ultra-right, the ultra-conservative fanatics, QAnon, that kind of thing. And while I was finishing this book off, the attack on the Capitol, the January attack, mm-hmm. occurred, which seemed to me to sort of bear out what I'd been afraid of. So I incorporated that into the book in a sort of passing reference as well. But you're right, it isn't really gentler and kinder, but the authorities are taking this threat more seriously. That's the main change that has happened.
And the fact that, in fact, they find out that it is an attack by a cult or a survivalist group. I think it was that survivalist group that got to me. I mean, the book is in two timelines. It's the past and the present, and then they sort of almost converge. But where did the survivalist group come from? Did it also come from your ideas about the ultra-right?
To an extent, but it was based on things that I had read, articles and blogs based in these isolated survivalist communities, some of them based in the Pacific Northwest, where most of the book is set. Very, very removed from community and from society. They regard themselves as sovereign citizens. They don't answer to the authority of state or federal authority. And I often think about what is it like for the women and children in these very remote and isolated patriarchal communities. What's it like growing up in those? And there have been some, you know, people who've escaped and told their own stories. And I read some of those stories. We even have stories like that in South Africa. And they're very interesting to hear these women speak and talk about what they went through.
There's a lot about female issues. I mean, what you're writing about shows the cruelty in this particular survivalist group. But, and your characters, your main characters are beautifully developed. But your main character, as I saw it, is Alia Knox, the FBI agent. And I think she might be your favorite character.
Yes, quite possibly my favorite in the book. She was a lot of fun to write. I think because she is so flawed and in many ways so unlike me. She's a brilliant and very gifted investigator, but she's been very damaged by her past. She was a child of adoption, a mixed race child who was adopted into a white evangelical community and has been damaged by that. She struggles with issues of alcoholism and low self-esteem, possibly sex addiction. She's very unfiltered. Yeah, as I say, she was a lot of fun to write, and I hope the readers will enjoy her while possibly not emulating her.
Hopefully not, but I must say that I enjoyed her tremendously, and she was so very, very authentic. In fact, all of your characters are authentic. I wish that we had more time to speak. Are you going to be talking about this with Gail on your Hidden Lives of Writers podcast? Because we could direct our listeners there as well afterwards.
I'm actually going to be speaking to Gus Silber about it on the podcast, which is available on all podcasting platforms. And Gail and I do chat about it and refer to it during our interviews as well.
Wonderful. Fiona, thank you so much for coming on board. I look forward to seeing you at Franschhoek.
Thank you for the chat.
Thank you.
that was Autumn Leaves by Track 5, right here on Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick. And today's show is, as always, sponsored by our friends at Exclusive Books, with much thanks. For the next one, we're joined by accomplished radio host and author Nancy Richards as she chats to Margie Orford about her memoir, Love and Fury. This is Margie Orford's first foray into nonfiction. She's a hugely accomplished crime fiction author. She's a South African. I think she lives overseas right now, but she regularly returns to South Africa. And this sounds like a fantastic memoir. Hi, Nancy, and welcome back to South Africa, Margie. Congratulations on this new release.
Born in the UK, raised in Namibia, stretched in Cape Town, and thereafter back and forth between the three, with a transit tranche and a study spell in New York in between, Margie Orford, now based in London, is what you might call a woman of the world. She sometimes claimed to be a South African writer, largely, I think, because her series of five crime thriller novels featuring the bold investigative journalist, criminal profiler Dr. Claire Hart, are set in Cape Town. But another significant feature of these, and of all her work really, is the attention it draws to the damage done to women. Well, Margie's work has covered novels, dissertations, manifesto, journalism, children's books, and includes workshops given to both rape survivors and male prisoners. But closer to home, her latest book, Love and Fury, a memoir published by Jonathan Ball, is undoubtedly her most personal work. Well, back in Cape Town right now for various launches, joins us in the studio. Lovely to have you back in Cape Town, Margie.
Wonderful to be here.
Are you pleased to be back? How does it feel?
It's lovely to be back. I come back often. So it's always lovely to be back.
Do you have a homecoming? Or are you conflicted about where is home?
No, I just belong in three different places and nowhere, I think is the best description.
You have a torn heart, I would say. Heart.
Divided, yeah. Divided heart.
I've just referred there to your, rather presumptuous, referred to your book as being your most personal work, but I suspect it might have been your most challenging. Yes, no?
It really was the most challenging. I've written fiction before. And in fiction, you can hide away all sorts of things that bother you, but they're obscured or kind of veiled by the story that you're making. And this one, Love and Fury, is a memoir, which is not really something I'd ever kind of set out to do or thought to do. But in it, I suppose, I'd got midlife sort of time, and I felt sort of compelled for a number of reasons to kind of give an account. How I'd been doing things had kind of run out of momentum. And my way of solving things is always by writing. So I looked at putting my own life into a story. As you said, I've dealt a lot with gender-based violence, with feminism, how to be a woman, and basically what it feels like to be alive, how to be alive. And I suppose that has been the subject.
Solving things. Your writing has been your way of solving things. I'm not suggesting for one minute that the book was necessarily cathartic, because that's awfully corny, but did it solve anything? I mean, reliving it, going back over it all, did it help you, as they say, unpack it?
Yes, it did in many ways. I mean, writing is never therapy, and I think it's a great sin for a writer to kind of beat up their reader with things that they haven't resolved themselves. So there are stories and anecdotes. For instance, I talk about my long marriage and then the divorce, and anyone who's been through a breakup, or even worse, endured a friend who's gone through a breakup, you know all the kind of cathartic conversations about how it was the most evil person, et cetera, et cetera. What was really interesting to me about, say, writing about that is writing about a relationship that had been so important and then had just went wrong, is that I re-understood both of them. You have to tell the truth if you write a memoir. And what you have to write the truth about, even people perhaps who've hurt you, is that there were years of love. So the most surprising gift for me was I did write about difficult things. I really did. But it returned to me in that example of the many years in which I loved and was happy with the man who's the father of my children. And that was a really surprising thing, is to understand the layers of the self. And I have worked with other people in their writing. How I imagined this book was a house into which to invite people. So I think writing, especially personal writing, has a kind of requirement of hospitality, that you entertain, that you host the people, you give them sustenance, and they leave your book house transformed, perhaps.
It's almost like another arrow in your quiver, because you have helped other people write, rape survivors, you've taught them poetry. the male prisoners, famously, you help these guys unload their stories. And helping people write their own story, I think, is on another level. You mentioned there that you have to write the truth if it's going to be memoir. As you remember it, you know, a memory is a slippery thing. But your memories seem to be very clear, like you're sort of re-feeling them all over again. Diaries, journals, in your writing, how did you acquire all these memories and truisms that you've used?
I think what you have to do, I do have journals, and I've noted down every wrong that's ever been committed against me in my illegible doctor's handwriting. So no one will ever be able to find
your enemies.
Yeah, but what I have managed, I think what the requirement is for specificity. So what brings a story to life is the specifics of what you ate and where you went and what the bodily experience of it, what it felt like to be alive in a particular moment. And for that, I brought what I've learned in fiction, how you create a living body on the page. That is what I went for, and specifics. And memory is like an archaeology. You dig down and you discover more and more. You blow off the dust. You realize what it is. Of course, a memory only exists in the present. It's not a police report of the past.
You know, once I think possibly you said it, that out of suffering comes great strong emotion, and you have poured both your love and your fury in this. You've also dedicated it to your three daughters. So, and it has a happy ending, if I can be a bit of a spoiler here. Very lastly, any regrets?
No regrets. I just should have started with nonfiction much earlier. Everyone seems to be so curious. It's like Skinner. It's pure Skinner.
Well, you'll have to live a whole nother life, but I feel we've got plenty more coming from your pen. Margie Orford, thank you so much. Margie Orford, author of Love and Fury, a memoir, and it's published by Jonathan Ball. Thank you.
That track was Kierboom by Tony Cox, and you're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your bookie host, Paige Nick. And this show is sponsored by Exclusive Books. I want to take a moment just to thank Mzu Makhetha for pulling together all these tracks for us. He really does have the best taste in very fine music. Thank you, Mzu, and thank you for pulling this show together. You do a great job of making us sound good. And for our final interview for today's show, we welcome Philip Todras, and he and Jonathan Anser are going to be talking a whole lot of bullshit. And by that I mean they're going to be talking about Jonathan Anser's latest book, which is called Bullshit. As I said in my intro, it comes out at a really good time, just as we're heading into election season, prime bullshit season. So we're very pleased to have Jonathan Anser on the show to unpack a bit of the history of South Africans' bullshit.
Bullshit. 50 Fibs That Made South Africa by Jonathan Anser. And I've got the man here himself, but I'm going to start off with a quote by Dr. and he's a historian, Dr. Bill Nassen, who writes your preface, and I hope we can rely on that being true. I hope so. Anyway, he talks about news journalism is the first rough draft of history. And I like that as a beginning, because I think what you are doing is you're sort of taking the rough draft and you're refining it somewhat. Would that be a good assessment?
I think I'd like to think that's a great assessment. That was what I intended to do, is to take the book looks at sort of past fibs, but also looks at current fibs. So I think it is trying to remind people of where we've come from and trying to look at history from a slightly different perspective, from a perspective of the lies that we've been told.
And the lies we've been brought up with. And I think maybe you want to refer to some perhaps in terms of our education, for instance.
Right, yeah. So the one lie we talk about is Shaka. And I remember some very, very colorful lectures, classes that I had at primary school. And what I did is I took all my memories of these classes, and I went and I contacted somebody who spent just about his whole life studying Shaka. And he told me whatever I'd been told or taught was just a pack of fibs.
You're talking about the battles and all of that, and where history began in South Africa, in fact.
That's right. You know, the whole empty land myth, which is something that actually was instrumental in creating this ideology of apartheid, and looking at actually it was a load of bullshit.
And then again, you also sort of see things in perspective in a more worldwide thing. You even mentioned Mr. Trump and the number of lies. And I was interested that yesterday in the Sunday Times, and even Mazibuko refers to lessons to be learnt from Zuma and Trump. So I think you got in first.
Well, Trump, you may see, sort of endorsed the book. He said, you know, make bullshit great again.
Well, I loved your opening. It says, what the critics said about bullshit. And I'm going to quote, I love it. Actually, I hate it. Although I adore it, I also despise it. Bloody agent. And that's attributed to Julius Malema. So can you tell us some things about some of the things that really struck you? Because politics, I don't know about the word lying. Maybe it's about how you have to compromise untruthfully. No.
Well, I think as we're heading into an election year, and we're going to see politicians going into lying overdrive, and I'm hoping that the book reminds readers to turn on their bullshit detectors so that when a politician says something, just take it with a pinch of salt. I think it's very important to open up our eyes and look at what is being said by these politicians so that we can make informed decisions. You won't be surprised to hear that a lot of the lies are from politicians, not all of them, but a lot of them are. And I think that says a great deal about politicians.
Well, you know, it's also not a South African phenomenon as well. And let's talk about corruption, which you also tend to cover as well. In America, they call it lobbying. Is there a difference?
I suppose it depends on who's doing the lobbying and who's doing the corruption. I think there tends to be a fine line. The corruption that I try and deal with stems all the way back to the apartheid days. And I think that is one of the lies, that corruption only started in 1994. Corruption started much earlier. And there is the whole Infogate scandal, where we saw a whole government was involved in kind of terrible, terrible corruption.
Not only corruption, but actually telling lies through a media which they owned.
That's right, yeah.
And maybe you just want to elaborate a little bit on that, because I think that's also very important, that dissemination of the lies.
That's right. So they got a front man, Louis Late, who you may remember was a big rugby boss. They wanted him to buy the Rand Daily Mail, which was a liberal English-speaking newspaper, in order to sway opinion in the English community. When that wasn't successful, they got him to start the Citizen newspaper, which was a propaganda tool. It was to put kind of a nice face on apartheid.
So we've just had something else happening at this day and age, so we won't go into those kind of details as well. But it's also interesting that, as you say, there are myths that are being created, and particularly now with social media, the volume becomes exponential. And I think people don't look to see what the source is. So if the lie goes out, the lie is, maybe you'd like to wrap up on warning us about that.
Yes, I do think we have to be very, very careful about, you know, we've got a responsibility ourselves to share and to make sure that we're not spreading false information and misinformation and, you know, disinformation. And I think that's very important. As we've seen, it's so difficult to tell what is true and what is a lie. And I'm hoping Bullshit will give readers some insights in how to turn on your bullshit detector and to call bullshit.
Truth be told, this is an exceptionally good read and will help you to do just that. We're talking to Jonathan Anser about his book, which has just come out, called Bullshit, 50 Fibs That Made South Africa. And we'll hope this book will help make it better.
That was an interview of Philip Todras chatting to Jonathan Anser about Bullshit, 50 Fibs That Made South Africa, and it's published by Jonathan Ball. I'm told that in Bullshit, Jonathan Anser proves to be a cynical cartoonist, using words rather than images to conjure up sharply satirical commentary. This sounds like a great gift, a great coffee table book, and something really useful, as I said, in these upcoming election months. And just like that, we've come to the end of our hour. It always goes so fast. It's like a good book. You just turn the pages and it keeps on going. We're going to play out with Rocco de Villiers, and he's playing Coming Home. But before that, I just want to thank all the reviewers and all the authors and all the publishers on today's show. Without you, we wouldn't have a show. And of course, without you, dear listener, we wouldn't have a show either. So I look forward to chatting to you again in 2 weeks' time, same place, about books and books and books. And until then, thank you for joining us and happy reading.